Agadatem Vasudev Vaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 24, The Philosophy of Sankhya, Text 7. Vaikarikas
Tejasas
Cha
Tamasas
Cheti
Aham
Trivretta
Matrendriya
Manasa
Karana
Achin Maya Vaikarikas Tejasascha Tamasas Chetyaham
Trivret
Tadmatrendriya Manasam Karanam Chid Achin Maya Vaikarikas Tejasascha Tamasas Chetyaham Trivret Tadmatrendriya
Manasa
Karanam Chidachin Maya
Karanam Chidachin Maya
Vaikarikas Tejasascha
Vaikarikas Tejasascha
Tamasas Chetyaham Trivret
Tamasas Chetyaham Trivret
Tanmatrendriya Manasa
Tanmatrendriya Manasa
Karanam Chidachin Maya
Karanam Chidachin Maya
Vaikarikas in the mode of goodness.
Tejasa
in the mode of passion.
Cha
and
Tamasa
in the mode of ignorance. Cha
also.
Iti thus. Aham. False ego. Trivret in three categories. Tatmatra of the subtle forms of sense objects. Indriya
of the senses.
Manasa
and of the mind.
Karana the cause. Chit achit.
Both spirit and matter.
Maya
encompassing.
Translation. False ego, which is the cause of physical sensation, the senses and the mind, encompasses both spirit and matter, and manifests in three varieties, in the modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance. Purport. The word chid achin maya, encompassing both spirit and matter, is significant in this regard. The false ego is the illusory combination of the eternal conscious soul and the temporary unconscious body. Because the spirit soul desires to exploit illicitly the creation of God, he is bewildered by the three modes of nature and assumes an illusory identity within the material world. Struggling to enjoy, he becomes more and more entangled in the complexities of illusion, and only increases his anxiety. This hopeless situation can be overcome by taking to pure Krishna consciousness, in which the pleasure of the Supreme Lord becomes the only goal of one's life. Vaikarikas Tejasas Cha Tamasas Chetyaham Trivret Tanmatrendriya Manasam Karanam chidachin mayam. False ego, which is the cause of physical sensation, the senses and the mind, encompasses both spirit and matter, and manifests in three varieties, in the modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prestaya Bhutale Shrimati Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namine Namaste Sarasvati Devi Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Pastichyade Shatarane Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Sri Vasudhi Gaura Bhakti Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare Panchakalpaturvya Stakripa Sindhuvya Vachapaditanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namaha. Philosophy of Sankhya. Sankhya literally means to enumerate, and in the sense of analyzing and distinguishing the different parts of a whole or a particular situation. So here, in this context, the Lord is explaining the philosophy of Sankhya, the analysis of material nature, material and spiritual natures, on the basis of the process of creation, the creation from the glance of Mahavishnu, or Krishna's glance. We see that in the two verses before, the Lord is saying that on the basis maya prakshobhya manaya, agitated by me. So, by Mahavishnu, but this is Krishna speaking. And he's saying, by me. He glances over the material nature, and then by the potency of the glance, by the potency of the glance, or one could say, because of the presence within the glance of various entities, various substantial things, so the unmanifested or inert material energy, the pradhan, is aroused, stimulated into action, you could say, or into a state of unfolding, unwinding itself back into what we call the manifest state. Of course, pradhan is manifest in the sense that it certainly exists, but it's not manifest in the sense that all the different component parts which are in it and actually which it consists of, they are not manifest in their specific positions, in their specific natures, in their specific rights as types of entities or things of their own natures. Sometimes we give the example of making a soup. Well, the scientists, we sometimes say, we sometimes mention the scientists give the example of the what they call the primordial soup, everything mixed up together at the beginning of creation, the beginning of the whole process, and then something happens, and after some time you have Chatsworth and everything else becomes manifest. So, in a certain sense, that concept could be perhaps utilized to some degree at least in the reverse sense, as we mentioned. When a person makes a soup, they start with the ingredients and they end up with some sort of, well, with a soup, which is essentially just, you could say, like a big mash of all the ingredients. And if it's really been cooked to that point where everything has just merged with everything else, then you cannot see, well, where's the water or the vegetables or the salt or the whatever it may be. You may not be able to see because it's attained that state, the soup state. So the example we give is, if you video that process and then play it backwards, you'll begin with the soup all mixed up together, and you'll end up with all the ingredients sitting on the table like that. So this process, in a certain sense, has a type of this process of creation or manifestation of this material world as we know it and as we experience it, a certain type of parallel could arguably be drawn in this sense. So it begins with the glance, and that glance, it is not like an ordinary person's glance, which doesn't really have a substance to it, but it's just, at least essentially, it's just them directing their capacity of vision, that potency of sight, directing it to something. This is a glance, and it is not exactly an entity or a thing, tangible thing. It's just a sensory process, at least more than anything else. But the Lord, his glance is not just a matter of something like that. His glance has substance. And as we've explained many times before, in the glance of the Lord, there are certain things, actual things. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur describes in his commentaries on Brahma Samhita that within the glance, there is the Kala Shakti, the potency of time. Then within the glance, there is the Icha Shakti, the potency of the Lord's desire. Particularly these two. Of course, they're also the living entities. So they're these three. And they're injected into the material nature, into the pradhan. And the way Srila Bhaktisiddhanta describes it is that the Kala Shakti, the potency of time, stimulates the karma of the living entities. And when the karma of the living entities is again set into action, having gone into a suspended state, then that is the impetus for, from that point at least, for the further development of this material world to the condition that we experience it in. And then conversely, at the time of the end of the creation, then the time Kala Shakti is withdrawn, and then the karma of the living entities stops, and they stop. And then everything winds up. And they're drawn into the body of Mahavishnu, eventually, in a state called Susupti, or deep sleep. So, you know, of course, that process at the end of everything being wound up, maybe that's got something more to do with the creation of a soup, because you end up with the pradhan. But here, Sankhya, this process, this practice, known as Sankhya, is being presented by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, specifically in the context of, at this point, of the manifestation of the material creation from the state of pradhan, of just being inert matter. And then by the glance of the Lord, the process of manifestation begins. So at this point in the discussion, at this point in the process of creation, very interesting thing happens, is that from the glance, the three modes become manifest to fulfill the desires of the conditioned souls. Then comes basically, well, what is referred to as the primeval sutra. The first transformation of material nature that manifests the potency of activity. Then, by transformation of the Mahatattva, is generated the false ego, the cause of the living entity's bewilderment. And then now in this verse, false ego is being described as the cause of physical sensation and those things connected, intimately connected with sensation, feeling, experience of different material stimuli. Those other things which are connected, the senses and the mind, they manifest. False ego is the cause of those things. So, false ego is described here as encompassing both spirit and matter. Very interesting point. Sometimes the tendency may be there to think that false ego is just simply material. Simply something material. Something separate from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Something separate from, in terms of our natures, our false ego, is something completely separate from our spiritual nature and our nature, particularly in the sense that we're all eternal servants of Krishna. But here, false ego is being described as encompassing both spirit and matter. The illusory combination of the eternal conscious soul and the temporary unconscious body. Of course, if we consider the situation, we see it has to be like that, because without the eternal conscious soul, then there can't be life, there can't be any type of ego or identity or personality and a way of life based on those things. But certainly, yes, false ego, it is a combination, actually. It is rooted. It has to be rooted in the eternal conscious nature of the spirit soul, even though it is covered over very strongly by matter, and therefore manifesting in the false way. Ishvaroham aham bhogi. Siddoham Balavam Sukhi. Lord Krishna also in Bhagavad Gita speaks those lines in the 16th chapter, just expressing, encapsulating the consciousness, the perspective on himself of the deeply conditioned soul, staunch materialist, or the demon, someone who is just determined, convinced that I am part of this material world and my program in life is exclusively to enjoy this material world and there's nothing other than that. If anyone suggests anything other than that, it is simply foolishness and just some sort of imagination. So Lord Krishna, he expresses their consciousness, their understanding of themselves in these terms in the 16th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Ishvaroham, I am the master, I am the controller. Ishvaroham, aham, bogi. And then, of course, I am the enjoyer. Siddoham, I'm perfect. Balavan, I'm very powerful. I possess great power. Siddoham, Balavan, Sukhi. And as a result of all these things, I am very happy in material existence. Srila Prabhupada gave the example when he was in hospital sometime. In the next bed was some gentleman who had been in some sort of major accident with many broken bones, so much of his body in plaster and suspended in different ways from the ceiling, and obviously shocking condition to be in. But when his relatives came at visiting time, they were foolish enough, if it were to be considered a serious question, they were foolish enough to ask the question, how are you? Of course, generally it's just a social nicety, but in such a situation they asked, how are you? And he responded, fine. So just see the condition, the unfortunate and pathetic condition actually of the conditioned souls, as Lord Krishna mentions in that verse in Bhagavad Gita, that they seriously think like that. I'm the controller. Even though I cannot control the hair coming out of my head or the digestion of my food or so many things I cannot control just within my own myself or my own body, and what to speak of the whole material world, and I'm the enjoyer despite the fact that I'm not enjoying very much. Even when I do enjoy, it's really nothing so special, and I don't even enjoy so much anyway, but rather I have to deal with many challenges and much unpleasantness of different types. But still they think like this. Siddoham, I'm perfect, I'm powerful, and I'm happy. Yes, so false ego then, it has to be rooted, ultimately at least, in spirit, on the spiritual platform, because false ego means type of consciousness, t- type of perspective on oneself. So like this, false ego, which manifests in vaikarika, taijasa, and tamasa, means very fundamental forms or states of the modes of material nature. Very, very fundamental. So false ego, under the influence of the modes of material nature, manifests like practically, first of all, physical sensation, the senses, and the mind. For false ego to function, for material consciousness, the materially conditioned soul, to function within this material world, in terms of the false ego, Ishvaroham Aham Bhogi, etc., then he has to have the senses, he has to have sensory capacities, he has to have a mind. Again, without these things, a false ego, a conscious living entity who really wants to enjoy material existence and so on, without these things can't function. And at least in material terms, without false ego, senses, just some senses, without a false ego, at least in the material sense, without a false ego, then material sensory capacity and material sense organs like that, without false ego, they also become useless. So it's a very intricate, the whole picture. Of course, it's being presented here in, you could say, relatively simple terms, foundational types of terms. But actually, the situation is one of extremely complex interdependence between all the different elements in the picture of what is the material creation, and behind what we see in material life, what we experience within this material world. But behind all of that, there is an extremely complex process. First of all, of bringing it into being, and secondly, in terms of it functioning on an ongoing basis. This we mentioned a few weeks ago. There was a verse which was referring to the three Purushas, in the sense, not the Purusha avatars, but the three Purushas, Adi Atmic, Adi Bhautik, and Adi Daivik. Of course, the initial discussion of that in that concept in Srimad Bhagavatam's there, I think, in the second canto, beginning of second canto, thereabouts, that you have within this material world, you have these three types of Purushas or persons, in a certain sense, persons. You have the Adiatmic Purusha, which is the Jiva or the conditioned soul. Then you have the Adibhautik Purusha, which is the material body. And then you have the Adidaivik Purusha, which is the basically the demigods, particularly in the sense of how they control the sensory functions of the embodied souls within this world. So the discussion there is that you have these three Purushas. Each one has its capacities, but without the assistance of the other Purushas, each of the Purushas cannot function. They're interdependent. That the conditioned soul without a material body cannot function because he's conditioned. When the soul is conditioned, it's not enough just to say, well, I'm a soul. And then one becomes situated as a pure living entity. When the soul is conditioned, then either he needs to become purified or he needs a material body. Otherwise he cannot function at all. And the material body, of course, without the presence of the soul, is also a dead body. And then the two of them, without the help of the demigods who give these, control the supply of these sensory capacities, the powers to see, the power to hear, and like that. Without their assistance, even the conditioned soul, with a very nice, relatively very nice material body, also cannot do anything. So all three had to be there for the conditioned soul to function, and even for that matter, the Adidaivik Purusha, the demigods who are controlling the sensory capabilities, if they don't have conditioned souls, embodied conditioned souls, to give those potencies to them, then they also become non-functional. So interdependency, all these things here are linked to each other in very amazing ways and very complex ways, actually. This is the creation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Behind it, well, we said there's great complexity. Behind the complexity is the intelligence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. What incredible intelligence to put such an arrangement together, have it manifest in this systematic step-by-step way, with each step leading to the next step, which leads to the next step. And then in the end you get this fantastic material creation. But of course the scientists would say it just happened by chance. Somehow or other, is quite an amazing conclusion. So, the situation, the complexity is there, the arrangement is there, and everything works, actually everything works perfectly, really. But because of the false ego, because of the consciousness, contaminated consciousness of the conditioned soul, while he's here within the material world, this brilliant arrangement of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, if he insists on functioning on the basis of false ego, Ishvaroham, I am the controller, aham bogi, I am the enjoyer, this is what I am. If he insists on operating on the basis of false ego, he remains entangled in a hopeless position in material existence. Because this is like the first feature. Practically the first feature of material existence is false ego. And everything else in material existence is rooted in that. So the conditioned soul has to pull out that root, pull out the plug of his material existence by understanding and accepting Jivera Swarupaya Krishnera Nityadas, Krishnera Tatasta Shakti Ved Abed Prakash. I'm actually the eternal servant of Krishna. And I am not this false ego, this false personality, this illusory combination of spirit and matter, conscious living entity with material body. I'm actually the eternal servant of the Lord. And then live on that basis. And then he can extricate himself from this amazing arrangement of this material world and ultimately that false ego, and go back home, back to Godhead. Any comments or questions? Maharaj, any comment for our enlightenment?
Yes.
About false ego.
Yeah.
It's the most subtle material element, so Prabhupada said. Sometimes he said it's neither matter nor spirit, but the place where the two touch.
Right.
So that's like a very subtle thing. Like you could take your finger and your thumb and put them together. The place where they touch, you know, where is that? If you try to like close your eyes and put your fingers, those two fingers together, where is that? Where exactly is the touching place? So that's a very subtle thing. So the meeting place between matter and spirit, that's fussy.
And it just, interesting point. The universe the universe as it's functioning is within like a cocoon of, which is made up of the material elements, one after the other. And each one is 10 times thicker than the other. And the last one, which is the thickest, is false ego. So, you know, if you do a calculation, if in the center it's 1 millimeter, then next is a centimeter, next is 10 centimeters, next is a meter. Just see, from 1 millimeter, next is 10 meters, next is 100 meters, that's 5, I think. Then next is 1 kilometer, then 10, then 100. That's on the basis of 1 millimeter being the size of the actual sort of active universe. So that false ego, that's a powerful thing. That's a big thing. So, not easy to get out.
That's why people are subtle and thick.
Yes.
Okay. The first question, 2 questions actually, is based on like living mountains. It's in the Puranas, there are mountains like which are living actually, and Lord Indra like took them.
To cut their wings off.
Yes.
Flying mountains.
Mm. You said that a living entity cannot function without senses. Like my understanding is that mountains are like innate nature, like mostly earth. And
well, from the description which we read in that light, it appears that those mountains were not inert matter. Okay. And because they, you know, would fly around, you know, going in intelligent ways. And even as I recall the description given by Srila Prabhupada, they rogue mountains would fly around and aggressively attack towns by landing on them. Yeah? And because they were attacking, they were becoming aggressive like that. Therefore, Indra cut their wings off. So, they had attained a condition of being a type of living entity. Yeah. I mean, at least in principle, they're simply combinations of material elements, which is what our bodies are, too. Yeah, so in that sense, you know, if a living entity is within some specific structure made of material elements, in principle, the possibility is there for that thing to start functioning as a living being. But even beyond that, you know, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna makes the point that the living entities are all pervading. And there's at least one discussion of Srila Prabhupada's I read. I think it was with Rabhatanandan. I'm sure you remember Rabhatanandan.
Yeah, very well.
Yeah. About how actually there are living entities, you know, in the chair. Even though we say, you know, dead matter. In the floor, we say dead matter. But actually, they're living entities there because they're sarvagata. They're all pervading. But as I recall, the way Prabhupada described it is that some living entities become so sinful, so, you know, in the extreme, it's not enough for them just to be put in hell or in the lowest species, the actual 8,400,000th species. But some of them, for some time, are thrown out of the species. They become so covered that they just become, well, just hidden in matter altogether. But then after some time, they're released and able to take material bodies again.
So the next question is about Icha. You said that the whole
Icha.
Good manifestation is like
Icha Shakti is the desire of the Lord.
The Lord. So my confusion here is that, okay, it's also based on chapter 11 of the Bhagavad Gita, universal form, when Krishna reveals to Arjuna that this whole cosmic manifestation, I mean, in terms of Kurukshetra, it's all been planned by me, but you are the instrument. So basically, according to the false ego, it seems that we are desiring actually, but our paths are like kind of controlled by the Lord. But in a way that, in a minute scale, it seems that we are the planners at the same time. So there's a confusion there. In the grand cosmic scale, it's the Lord. But
see, the thing is, on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, it was specifically Krishna's plan to alter the path of history in a specific way. And, you know, therefore, you know, like, it's a very specific personal desire of the Lord to do away with the demons, establish the devotees, establish Dharma, established Bhagavad Gita and Krishna consciousness. Yeah. Now, and therefore he appeared. It's one of the important reasons why he appeared 5,000 years ago to do that. But just in a sort of general sense, here we are, you know, here the people are in the shopping center across the road and they're just doing this and doing that. You know, and it's not that they are functioning in a vacuum or, you know, like independent of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He is certainly connected and he is involved to some degree. You know, at the very least, he's involved to the degree that he sees they get their karma. Someone, you know, they're working to achieve something. They achieve it. They may achieve more, they may achieve less. So the results of activities are coming in terms of karma, and so many things are coming. Everything is coming in terms of karma, which the Lord is controlling. And you cannot say, well, look, you know, I think I won't take this karma. Thank you. You will take it. You'll take it. And the Lord, ultimately the Lord at least, immediately the demigods, but ultimately the Lord is seeing that you get it. And in that sense, your life is being controlled to some degree. not absolutely controlled like you're just a robot moving around. You know, you may desire, well, let me use, if in terms of your karma you get some money, then you have a degree of freedom to think, I could use it in this way, I could use it in that way. So, you know, it is a little intricate situation, of course, but there's no doubt that there's an element of independent capacity to desire. Yeah, there's an element of free will. It's not absolutely free will, but it's also not just a robotic situation of just being manipulated totally. But it is a combination, because we are being manipulated to some degree, no doubt, by our karma. Of course, we created the karma, but our getting the karma, you know, how it comes, that's under the control of the Lord. So in that sense, in principle, there's a difference between the situation on the battlefield. Krishna says, just fight. And, you know, the result is already decided by me. And our situation, there's a difference.
The last one is a mundane question, but it has to do with the phenomenon of dinosaurs. I've heard from one of the devotees that Prabhupada said that they come at the end of Kali, the age of Kali. They are there in the other dimensions of the universe. And here on Earth, they were also here looking at things, but they kind of manifest in Kali Yuga towards the end. So I don't know. Kind of mundane.
You know, certainly the Bhagavatam says, or Puranic literature says, that as Kali Yuga progresses, people become smaller and less capable. And, you know, I can't remember exactly where I read it, but that reptiles and things get bigger. So, yeah. So it may well be that, I mean, they found, sort of complete fossils, as I understand. This is at least what we're told. Complete fossils of gigantic type creatures, which are not present now. Some say they're from the end of the previous Kali Yuga. But they're not from this time. They must be from some time. So, you know, when that time was, I can't remember if I've read some specific sort of statement like that. But, you know, assuming that they're real and they're not just manufactured by the scientists, you know, it's an interesting question, but assuming they're real, then obviously they're not living now, at least we don't see them. They must have been living in some previous time. Whether that necessarily was the previous Kali Yuga, or when that time may have been, well, I don't know, but assuming they're real, they must have been living at some other time when life was different on this planet. Do you have any sort of comment on that? It's going into a sort of, you know, an ethereal type of region. And, you know, it's also not important for our Krishna consciousness. You know, if the dinosaurs are going to come again, you know, by whatever means, you know, interplanetary, if they fly in from somewhere else, or if the reptiles are just going to grow or what,
we'll find out what language they speak and could look speak.
Well, we hope to not be around by that time. We hope to get out of this material world and go back to Godhead before too long, you know, we hope. Yeah. So in that sense, it's more just sort of like peripheral, interesting subject matter, rather than, you know, we've got to understand this. It's part of our Krishna consciousness. Yes.
So just in regard to one of the earlier questions you made about the mountains, and you were talking about how Prabhupada said the spirits are okay.
Yeah.
Prabhupada also said that the spirit in the diamond has got that body because it's the personification of envy. So we shouldn't actually have diamonds. We shouldn't wear diamonds.
Prabhupada said that?
Yes.
People will ask you, where did he say that? So if I was you, I'd look it up.
I mean,
I'm not disagreeing with you in the slightest. You know, there's a description of, what's the name of this stone? I forget the name of the stone, but some stone which it's like some sunstone or something like that.
Huh?
No, there's some particular stone we were reading about a while ago, and there's, because these stones, these gems, used to be self-effulgent, and they would use them for lighting inside buildings, you know, gem-encrusted walls and ceilings. So they're living entities within them. Yeah. Therefore, they have some effulgence.
You yeah. Rocks, you stones.
And I think I've also noticed that they talk about using emeralds and rubies, and you know, when they're talking about decorations, they're mentioning all these beautiful rocks, but they're not saying diamonds.
Oh, I see.
You know, they leave the diamond out quite.
Okay, interesting. Interesting point. Thank you. Srila Prabhupada Ki.
Because South Africa has an opera.